Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and this is On Point. Today is the state funeral of the nation's 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush. It's a time to focus on his achievements, not to rehash the rough and tumble and the criticisms and controversies of his tenure in office. And when it comes to Bush's foreign policy record, his accomplishments were many. In that aspect of his presidency, history is proving very kind to the first Bush. This hour on Point, President George H.W. Bush on the world stage. Join us. Let us know how you think he compares in world affairs to the presidents who came after him. Do you remember the fall of the Berlin Wall, the first Gulf War, the Panama invasion? Because he was the country's leader during those tumultuous times. Tell us how you would assess George H.W. Bush's foreign policy work and how you think the international decisions he made may still be playing out today. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from London is Corey Shockey. She served in the Department of Defense in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and on the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration. She was also a foreign policy advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. Today, she is Deputy Director General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. Corey Shockey, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Sasha.
And joining us from Washington is James Goldgeier. He's a visiting senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international relations at American University. He holds the Kissinger Chair at the Library of Congress, and he served at the State Department and National Security Council in the Clinton administration. James, welcome to you, too.
How are you, Sasha?
I'm good. And Corey and James, I touched on this in our intro, but can you give us the lay of the land in the late 80s and early 90s when George H.W. Bush was president? Because it was such a different time in the world. So many momentous things happening. The Berlin Wall fell. Germany reunified. Soviet Union crumbled. Cold War ended. Bush was in office during all of that and to a great degree helped guide that transition. Could you take turns reminding us what the world looked like then?
Absolutely. But Jim, why don't you start? Because your terrific books on American foreign policy in this period are definitive.
Well, thanks, Corey. So it was an incredible period in terms of both the tension and exhilaration. The Cold War really had ended by the time Bush became president. Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev had really pushed forward toward the end of the Cold War. By December of 1988, Gorbachev went to the United Nations and unilaterally declared some disarmament measures. He went there to give what he called the anti-Fulton speech in reference to Winston Churchill's Fulton, Missouri speech soon after World War II that talked about the Iron Curtain falling across Europe. But there was still a lot to manage with respect to the transition from Cold War to post-Cold War. Sasha, as you just mentioned, the fall of the wall and George H.W. Bush's incredible role in managing with the Soviet leadership the transition from Cold War to post-Cold War, and especially, I think, his achievement of fostering German unification, which was not a given. There was opposition not only from the Soviet Union, but from British and French leaders, and working with all of them and the German Chancellor, West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, was able to achieve something quite remarkable.
And James, would you elaborate a little on how much credit Bush deserves for the management? Because as you said, the Cold War at least largely ended under Reagan, and Bush himself has said that he often felt that he lived in the shadow of Reagan, the very charismatic man. How much was done by the time Bush came in, and how much work was there really left that required skill?
Well, there was a lot of skill required because we didn't really know what was coming after. There was a lot of uncertainty. It could have been bloody. It was not. The fact that the Soviet Union ended up collapsing without major war is an achievement that goes not just to the leaders in the West who were assisting, but Gorbachev and also Boris Yeltsin, who became president of Russia. So there's a lot of things that could have gone wrong, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's hard to assess the legacy, because we don't know the things that might have gone wrong. But Bush, because of his experience, because really of his caution and because he put a great team together, was really able to manage the situation quite skillfully.
Right. There are people who say he avoided tragedies, but as you've pointed out, it's hard to measure the impact of things that didn't happen.
So I can give you one concrete example in that regard. I was the NATO desk officer in the strategy shop in General Powell's joint staff at the time. And so I was the guy working the nuts and bolts of German unification. And as James says, there was, you know, Chancellor Kohl understood that windows of opportunity open and close, and he was willing to trade almost anything to get Germany unified. And one of the things he was willing to trade away was Germany's NATO membership. And because President Bush and his administration were so well trusted and so well regarded, we had people in the German government coming to us to tell us what was going on in their internal negotiations so that we could foreclose the opportunity of Germany being required to give up its NATO membership. And one of the reasons President Bush understood the importance of that was he and the team of national security leaders that he gathered around him, they were Eisenhower administration fans. They understood that you need to worry about a Europe with Germany untethered, and that the great success of the Cold War was anchoring Germany firmly in a community of values and common security in the West, and that you needed to sustain Germany in that way. And so Bush took a really hard line on that and got the German government to concede it and got the Russians to concede it. And that was really tough-minded negotiation. So he was tactful, he was graceful, but he also fought hard for the stuff that was important.
Could one or both of you also remind us issues like Noriega in Panama, Kuwait, Iraq? These are also things that happened during George H.W. Bush's tenure in the White House.
Go ahead, Corey.
Sure. I'll take Iraq, which is that, you know, President Bush understood that with the end of the Cold War, all of the rules of the international order were going to be both up for reevaluation and up for challenge. And Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in the summer of 1990 was an attempt to rewrite the rules. And President Bush understood that if you didn't defend the principle of international order, that you don't get to change existing boundaries by force. Unless that were upheld, that all of Europe could again come unraveled, that countries that had minorities that were that didn't feel they were being properly acknowledged or treated by existing government, that everything could come unraveled if force was allowed to become the determiner of these. And so that, as much as anything else, was the rationale for putting together a large international coalition of troop-contributing countries to defend the United Nations Security Council and the rules that they were putting in place. I would just say parenthetically, I would just remind people that the Bush administration was so good at their job that the United States sent 400,000 troops and turned a profit on the undertaking because James Baker, the Secretary of State, persuaded countries like Japan that weren't going to, for obvious historical reasons, fight in the war, to help uphold the international order that had served them so well. So you put together a large coalition of countries from the region and beyond under U.S. leadership. They ejected Iraq from Kuwait, and then, as James has pointed out, they didn't change their objectives once they were winning. They understood, they had the strategic restraint to understand that the Middle East would be a different place if you overthrew Saddam Hussein.
Right, and we should talk more about that later that hour, because the decision not to do so, of course, had ripple effects that played out later and continue to play out. But we'll come back to that. I first want to play a piece of sound from Colin Powell, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Bush. He was on ABC's This Week recently, and he called Bush the nation's top foreign policy president.
Everything he thought of, everything he did in public life was always directed to helping the American people. He was a patriot. He demonstrated that in war. He demonstrated that in peace. He was the most qualified person with respect to foreign policy ever to serve as president of the United States of America.
James Goldgeier, when people die, we can sometimes elevate them to sainthood, perhaps more than they deserve. But could you let us know whether you think that that assessment, the nation's best foreign policy president in its history, is a fair characterization of George H.W. Bush?
Well, he was certainly the most qualified, and he had some enormous successes. And I think it's worth recognizing that with the end of the Cold War, we haven't elected presidents who've had that kind of foreign policy experience. We've had individuals who have run for office. As you mentioned, Corey advised the campaign of Senator John McCain, who, had he become president, would have had significant foreign policy experience. And certainly Hillary Clinton also had significant foreign policy experience. That's not something we've looked for in a president since the end of the Cold War. And it's partly why George H.W. Bush stands out so much as we look back at his legacy. It also was a challenge for him because he was so qualified on foreign policy, cared so much about it, and did so much in foreign policy that he wasn't paying as much attention, perhaps, as to domestic policy as he should have. And it's one of the ways in which Bill Clinton was able to win the election of 1992 by arguing it's the economy, stupid, and George H.W. Bush's foreign policy achievements did not help him in his reelection campaign.
That's right. It's quite amazing when you think that Bush came out of the first Gulf War with something like an 85% approval rating, a war that was viewed as one in 100 hours. And then, about a year later, he's beaten, in part because, as you said, the economy changed. People felt like he focused on foreign policy a bit and neglected domestic policy. So we will continue to talk all about that after we take a brief break. We're taking stock of George H.W. Bush's legacy as a foreign policy president and his reputation as a statesman on the world stage. Join this conversation. Tell us what you remember from his time in office. If you weren't a voting age back then, is there anything that surprises you and all that you've been hearing about George H.W. Bush in recent days? We already have some callers interested in weighing in. We're going to hear from them when we come back after a break. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're looking back at the foreign policy legacy of President George H.W. Bush. He's often called the best foreign policy president ever. Join this conversation. Let us know if you wish that the United States still advocated for the type of internationalist policies that Bush advocated, his outreach to other countries, his collaboration with many foreign nations. Or do you think those policies are what have gotten us in trouble in recent years? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Corey Shockey, Deputy Director General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, and James Goldgeier, Visiting Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and Professor of International Relations at American University. And we're joined by another voice. This is Bruce Gentleson. He's a professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's also author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. And Corey mentioned earlier in the hour that, as she called it, he's written some terrific books, many of them, including one called America Between the Wars from 11-9 to 9-11. Bruce joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, and hi, Jim and Corey.
Hey, Bruce.
And I want to run a bit through George H.W. Bush's biography, because we've been talking about the wealth of foreign policy experience he brought to the office. He had been ambassador to the UN before he became president, U.S. envoy to China. He was director of the CIA. He had been a Navy pilot who flew around the world. This is a man who spent 40 years in government positions and became president with a real understanding, many people believe, of foreign policy in a way that didn't require him to learn on the job. He basically came in with a great wealth of knowledge. Bruce, give us your quick assessment of, looking back, how much we can say that George Bush was one of the best foreign policy presidents ever. And is that a deserved accolade?
Yeah, I think in your previous segment, you quoted General Powell. And as you just said, he was incredibly experienced. And it's quite a contrast with virtually every president since him. Bill Clinton, former governor of Arkansas, George W. Bush, Texas, Obama, Trump, et cetera, who haven't had that experience. I don't know if that I'd make that statement that he's the best president in the history for foreign policy. Two others come to mind, Franklin Roosevelt and World War II and the creation of the United Nations and many other things. We can go back to Thomas Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase, which, you know, was truly an art of the deal, we might say. So he was very experienced. He did a very excellent job in the issues that you've been talking about. There were some other sides too. You know, when he came in, he actually originally stepped back from the Reagan-Gorbachev relationship and really spent a year reassessing a lot of studies. And many people thought that was a lost year that contributed to Gorbachev's own problems at home. Ambassador Jack Matlock, who was U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union then, you know, called it the lost year in his memoirs, and one of Gorbachev's aides called it Washington fumble. So, you know, Gorbachev's problems were largely created by Gorbachev, but we have to see both sides, both the way that George Bush did not dance on the Berlin Wall and help consolidate, like Corey and Jim said, Germany and others. But that cautiousness had a downside, too, and that 1989 relations with Gorbachev is a good example of that.
That's a very important aspect of his personality to raise, because, as you said, he famously said, "I'm not going to dance on the wall," when the Berlin Wall went down. He didn't want gloating. He worried that the Soviet Union could dissolve in a violent way, and he wanted to make it a peaceful one. He was often criticized for being too cautious. People called him wimpy. You know, in retrospect, people say, no, that was just very pragmatic, cautious conservatism. Here's a clip of Bush himself addressing that.
"You don't seem elated, and I'm wondering if you're thinking of the problems."
"I'm not an emotional kind of guy."
"Well, how elated are you?"
"Well, I'm very pleased. And I've been very pleased with a lot of other developments. And as I've told you, I think the United States part of this, which is not related to this development today particularly, is being handled in a proper fashion."
That was George H.W. Bush answering reporters' questions in the Oval Office as he defended his kind of slow, cautious approach. Corey and James, your thoughts about how some of the personal qualities that Bush was criticized for when he was president, now many people are saying deserve a lot of praise, especially in contrast to the style we now see in the White House.
God, yes. We're homesick for integrity and decency and the belief that how you comport yourself is an important strategic asset for the United States and the world. I also think, though, that, you know, the biggest challenge thrown against Bush in his own time as president was the vision thing, right? That he lacked a vision. And I think that's unfair. He couldn't articulate a vision. He wasn't a particularly articulate man. But he actually did have one, which was to navigate the events of his time in a way that strengthened the United States and its allies in the world. That's why he supported German unification. That's why he engaged in the war in the Middle East. That's why he tried to strengthen relationships with Japan and South Korea. That's why he moved so adroitly to reduce the amount of nuclear weapons in America's arsenal. He made a whole series of choices that reset the table for what the post-Cold War order would be like. And he actually did have a vision for that. He just couldn't articulate that vision. But even better than articulating it, he enacted it.
We have a full board of callers, so let's go and hear from some of them, and then we'll come back to our guests. This is David calling from Akron, Ohio. David, thanks for calling on Point, and give us a sense of how you would assess the legacy of George H.W. Bush, particularly when it came to his foreign policy.
Well, hi, Sasha. I'm interested in all this talk about the foreign policy, and I'll be honest with you, I never thought much of it in the time that he was president. And I'm a political fanatic. I'm more involved in politics than I would like to be and follow it closely. I think of this George Bush as being someone who kind of took the presidency with a Hippocratic oath in that he was determined not to do any harm. And he not only didn't do any harm, he did a great amount of good. Not the least of which I have a stepson that was in the Kuwait war and brought him home safely. And, you know, he was cautious, but you have to be cautious. And it's such a contrast to what we're seeing now from that office. It's regrettable is what it is.
David, you said that despite being what you called a political fanatic, when Bush was in office, you didn't think much about his foreign policy. Why do you think that was the case, and even though there's so much emphasis on it now?
I don't know. I appreciated the comment by Colin Powell, another one of my favorite people in our history. And in fact, I wrote him in for president last when Trump was running. I couldn't put an X beside either one of the candidates, and I knew Colin wasn't going to go anywhere, but he's a man I greatly respect. I just, you know, he did things, and you knew that, you know, he conducted the war in Kuwait admirably and, you know, with the help of General Schwarzkopf, and he didn't blow his own horn. He didn't say, look, I did this, look, I did this, look how great I am. It's what we did. And he got along with other countries rather than the contrast with what we're going through now. It just keeps in the back of my mind where we're alienating former friends in the world, and they wonder what in the world is going on and where is their place in this new world that seems to be developing. I hope at some point soon somehow this gets reversed and it goes back to having somebody in the office with George Bush common sense and common decency. I think if I had to put my take on him as a person and as a president, so he was a decent, good man.
David, thank you for that. That was David from Akron. And I want to note that David talked about Bush not wanting to sort of brag or talk about himself. He often talked about how that was imbued in him by his family, particularly his mother. She thought it was unseemly to refer to yourself too much. He grew up in a very aristocratic family where manners were very important. That was a big issue for him. Let's also go to Barbara calling from Binghamton, New York. Barbara, thanks for calling on Point and your thoughts about George H.W. Bush and particularly his foreign policy work.
Thanks for taking my call. I think that we're looking back on it perhaps with some rose-colored glasses. As all of the other callers have said, the contrast is amazing between Bush and Trump. And while I remember not liking Bush when he was in office, again, like everybody else, and basically because of the Clinton campaign, we were looking at the economy, and so we're not as conscious of foreign policy, but we didn't need to be because Bush hadn't been making a huge stink over it.
And it was a pre-9/11 world, so there were different types of issues we were dealing with.
Exactly. And it was a matter of assuming that we were the superpower and the Berlin Wall was going down and we had won the Gulf War, but we expected to. So but you know, all of that being said, I would infinitely prefer his attitude toward our foreign, toward foreign governments, toward our friends and our foes, to what we have now.
Barbara, thank you for that. And I want to put one of your thoughts to Bruce Gentleson, one of our guests. Barbara talked about, are we viewing this through rose-colored glasses? And I want to note that particularly on social media comments to the show, they seem to be much more critical. There's one person talking about the Iraq war paving the way for what he calls forever wars in places most Americans can't find on a map. He says Bush's legacy is death and destruction. Another person says there's much blood on that man's hands. There is a one caller who notes that in our introduction we said a funeral is not a day for criticism, but she writes, this program is not a memorial service. Criticisms of any past administration are valid for a better future. So, Bruce Gentleson, how much do we factor in that kind of criticism as we assess George H.W. Bush's foreign policy legacy?
Yeah, I think it is important to have a balanced view, kind of two-column accounting when we think about presidents. And, you know, the contrast between Bush, both in the personal style that he had as well as his policies and the current president, is kind of irresistible, you know, as your callers have said. You know, at the same time, you learn from both. So when there was the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, many people were critical of the Bush policy in terms of not responding to that in ways that people felt were necessary to affirm American human rights. And even the Iraq War, as well as it was handled, the lead up to that, you know, I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but the way the Bush administration handled relations with Iraq from when they were elected till the invasion of Kuwait, they were kind of almost blinded by the anti-Iran ideology and didn't pay enough attention to things that Saddam was doing. At the same time, though, I would say the thing I most respect about President Bush is that he didn't go in for these categories. He was both, he believed in America's role and America's power, and he was a multilateralist. He and Gorbachev went to the UN in 1992 and talked about what a new world order would look like. And, you know, he was willing to work with others, with allies, with others. He didn't let allies off the hook. He and James Baker put a lot of pressure on the Israelis when they were expanding their settlements. It hasn't been just Barack Obama. So there are many things about the way he went about it and the way he made decisions, very deliberate, you know, non-impetuous. They had a process before they decided to take a military action against Iraq after the invasion of Kuwait. And you really have to respect that, as well as seeing some decisions you don't agree with. It comes out net positive for me, but it is useful to kind of do both columns of the accounting, if you will.
This is Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point. We are talking about George H.W. Bush's foreign policy legacy on the day of his funeral. He came into office with a very extensive international, global foreign policy record. And he was president in a very, very different time than we have now. We have several more callers wanting to weigh in. So let's go to Kevin, calling from Owego, New York. Kevin, thanks for calling On Point. And let us know, how do you assess Bush's record?
Well, overall, I would say it's neutral to positive. However, the one incident that I recall that were personally was the Iraq War, for which I was activated. I remember how skillfully he mastered gathering international support to push Iraq out of Kuwait. And I can vividly remember his words after 4 days of the ground war, after 30 days of the air war, of hostilities have ceased. There was no expectation that it was going to be a short war when it started, and I think that was a credit to General Powell and the Powell Doctrine, which was know your objective, go in with overwhelming force, and have an exit strategy. There has been no war since. We've been 18 years in Afghanistan, and we fought to a stalemate. I think if the U.S. government followed the Powell Doctrine, we would be in a lot less trouble militarily worldwide.
Kevin, thank you for that, and that's an important point to raise, because clearly, obviously, Iraq is still an issue today. Bush decided not to overthrow Saddam Hussein. He did say later that he thought that Saddam would be overthrown once the war ended. That didn't happen. His son obviously went back later to do that. That continues to play out today. James Goldgeier, is that something you can talk to us about? Talk to us about how the decision that Bush made, the elder Bush back then, how did that plant the seeds for where we are today? The fact that that's still a gigantic global issue, is that a failure of some kind on Bush's part for not laying the groundwork correctly, or is it a failure of his successors?
Well, I think you just mentioned the Bush team did think that Saddam would fall in the aftermath of the war. That was a miscalculation. But it is important to remember why the United States didn't go to Baghdad at that time. As has been discussed both by Corey and your callers, the United States had put together an extraordinary international coalition. Bush and James Baker, Secretary of State, worked very hard to put that coalition together. And that coalition led to the UN authorization to eject the Iraqi military from Kuwait, restore Kuwait's independence. And the Bush team didn't want to go further than that because that would have broken that international coalition. And it's important to remember, a Republican president who cared about that international coalition and cared about working through the United Nations. And I think that's an important part of his legacy. But it did leave the problem for his successors, Clinton patrolling the no-fly zones, George W. Bush invading Iraq, and then Barack Obama having to go back in because of ISIS.
That's right, a huge, huge ongoing debated piece of American foreign policy legacy. We're looking at that foreign policy legacy of the 41st president, George H.W. Bush, whose funeral is today. Join the conversation, especially at this time when Russia and the U.S. are talking of pulling out of nuclear missile treaties. Do you miss the detente and cooperation of the Bush years he was involved in nuclear missile reduction? As our military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq drag on nearly two decades, what do you make of the first Gulf War lasting less than a month? I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking this hour why President George H.W. Bush, whose funeral is today, is so well-regarded when it comes to foreign policy. Join the conversation. Let us know if you think his walk-softly style, his cautious and pragmatic and what some people even called a docile approach, would work in today's world, or has the world changed too much for that? Is a more aggressive, chest-beating approach and a more inward-looking style more effective today? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at Outpoint Radio. My guests are Bruce Gentleson, a professor at Duke University, James Goldgeier, a visiting senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Corey Shockey, Deputy Director General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. She served under both Bush presidents. And Corey, I want to go back to you because you had talked about the things you very much miss from the Bush administration. But there are people who believe that his very international approach, and some people think it to the neglect of a domestic agenda, got us into the type of trouble they think we're in today. They feel like in some ways it laid the seeds for what happened on 9/11. Can you talk at all about whether you think that despite the praise he gets for his foreign policy, did it lay the groundwork for things that played out in a not very advantageous way for the U.S.?
It did not. That is a manifestly unfair charge to lay at the first Bush administration's door. The fact that they did not solve every problem in the international order doesn't mean they are responsible for problems that developed subsequently. I would suggest to you, for example, that the restraint that they took in order to solve the biggest problems right, to gracefully manage the collapse of the Soviet Union, to get consolidated control over the nuclear weapons that were outside of Russia's territory, to build a basic and cooperative relationship with the Russian leadership that would buffer against any miscalculations as Soviet power was dramatically dropping and America's standing was becoming much more predominant, to get Germany peacefully unified and in the West, to reduce by several thousand the number of, unilaterally, by the way, the number of U.S. nuclear weapons, to create more strategic stability. Those are huge achievements. And the fact that he didn't do everything, I really think doesn't detract from all that he did do and doesn't mean he should be blamed for the growth of jihadism or other things that were not the problems of his time.
Corey Shockey, we have a piece of tape from Bush himself in 1990, who, even though, as he once said, he may not have been very strong on the vision thing, as he called it, he did have a sense of what he was trying to achieve. And so let's listen to that tape again from 1990. This is when he's speaking to Congress about the world he hoped could become.
Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge, a new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. An era in which the nations of the world, east and west, north and south, can prosper and live in harmony.
James Goldgeier and Bruce Gentleson, again, that was 1990. That's a time when Bush believed, it sounds like he was laying the groundwork for that. For a long time, it seemed like that groundwork was in place. We're at a moment in world history now where it feels like that's unraveling in many ways. What do you make of that? Why are we feeling like there's such a 180-degree difference from the world as Bush tried to leave it and where we are now?
Go ahead, Jim. I'll follow.
Well, so I think, you know, what's occurred since then, and again, putting back, I agree with everything Corey said, and you have to remember that moment when America was the undisputed leader in the world, and, you know, it was really about managing a process, belief in working through international institutions to do it. We were just seeing the beginnings of globalization. And, you know, a lot of what has occurred since then has really been sort of backlashes against that period, backlash from other countries against American hegemony and American global leadership, the problems that globalization created lots of opportunities for lots of people, but it also led to lost jobs and great difficulties for certain individuals and created enormous inequalities. So, again, as Corey said, these aren't things that were Bush's fault, but he represents a period for which there has been enormous backlash since then, and a lot of people, both in the United States and abroad, trying to come to grips with the kind of world that emerged after the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's over a quarter century since George Bush was president, and if we use that same amount of time, you know, when we entered World War One, 1917, you go a quarter century forward and we're just entering World War Two, and a whole lot of things happen in between, and you can't say that 1917 caused 1942. But I think that it really is a very complicated period for Americans now, because the 1990s felt like we were on top of the world. It felt like at least we won, they lost. That was the end of history period. Supposedly everybody was moving towards capitalism and democracy. And it clearly hasn't worked out that way. And I say this not just as a commentary on the Trump policies, because in many respects, kind of like what Jim was saying about globalization, Trump was an effect, not just a cause. You know, so was the vote on Brexit. And people are confused. The world has changed in so many ways, and we're trying to figure out what our role is in the world. It's not going to be the same as it was in the first 50 years after World War II, because it's a different world. We can't be isolationists and come home. We can't go bashing allies like this administration does because they have cards to play too. So I think in people's, you know, a little bit of anxiety about what's going on in the world, you know, people are making these connections. And, you know, Bush didn't solve all the problems on an ongoing basis, but he handled his period, again, with some criticisms, but overall really quite well. And then other predecessors have made their marks, and now we're in a very different world in the second decade of the 21st century.
I'm wondering whether there has to be an either-or between internationalism and being more inwardly focused. I'm thinking, for example, about NAFTA, which was something that connected us to other countries but resulted in jobs lost in the U.S. As I recall, Bush negotiated that, even though Clinton put it through Congress. Is there something different Bush could have done so that people later couldn't point to NAFTA and say, that cost me my job?
I don't think so. I think that was, and I actually was in the Clinton administration when and working for Vice President Gore when he was the lead person on NAFTA, even debating Ross Perot in a pretty funny CNN televised debate of the day. I think that, you know, you have to adjust these things. I mean, the agreement on NAFTA in 1993, if there were mistakes, it wasn't having the kind of reviews, not to get out of it, but that could allow you to make adjustments along the way and break out of the notion that while overall it helped the American economy, it really did hurt certain segments. And we could have dealt with those segments through domestic policy and stayed in NAFTA. We could have had various adjustment strategies for people from the manufacturing sector and elsewhere. And no administration really figured out how to do that in a way that was effective, not just throwing money at the problem.
Let's hear from some more callers. This is Tushar calling from Dayton, Ohio. Thanks for calling On Point, and let us know how you would assess George H.W. Bush's foreign policy record.
Well, hello, Sasha, and hello to your panel. I want to push back against something that you mentioned earlier in your show, how you said that 41 was the best foreign policy president, and that one of your other panelists said, and gave the example of FDR with the creation of the UN. I want to bring our attention to President James Monroe and the Monroe Doctrine and kind of pushing out the influence of the Western European powers from the American domain was a pretty concrete and monolithic establishment of American dominance for foreign policy. So I think it's a little short-sighted to say that one person can outshine 242 years of administration. And then my second point would be analyzing and assessing 41's presidency from an academic perspective, I would give his foreign policy a B+.
A B plus? B as in boy? B plus?
B as in boy. B as in beta, yes. We saw on the 17th of April in 89 with what was going on in Poland, there was a massive establishment of American support for bilateral negotiations between the Communist and Solidarity Party of Poland, and that created, got rid of single-party rule in Poland. So that's a major boon. But then immediately following in June, we saw Tiananmen Square. And then the day after, 41 condemned what happened in Tiananmen Square, but didn't really go far enough. We could have crippled China with economic sanctions, but instead we only chose to, suspend military sales.
Right. He was heavily criticized for that. Limited sanctions, even though hundreds of protesters died. People felt like that was not strong a reaction enough.
Well, we've had uncovered some British diplomatic cables that said 10,000 people died in Tiananmen Square. So what happened in the American response to the lead-up and the follow-up after Tiananmen Square was kind of muted, in my opinion. There could have been so much more that could have happened. But then immediately following, in June, you had the fall of the Berlin Wall and the unification of Germany, which kind of outshadowed what happened in Tiananmen Square. So, you know, you have a lot of things going on in that regard. But then after unification, you have the invasion of Panama. So you see an ability for this president to use military force whenever the risks are very low and you can kind of bully smaller countries. Like
Tushar, thank you for that. We have a number of calls. Let me try to bring some more in before we go back to our guests. This is Charlie calling from Boston. Charlie, thanks for calling On Point and your thoughts about how you would assess George H.W. Bush and his foreign policy record.
Hi. I think one of the things a lot of people forget is that George Bush was instrumental in putting Saddam Hussein in power in the first place in the 1980s. As vice president, he personally, worked with Saddam Hussein, kept him in power, even as a Sunni minority in a Shiite majority country. and Iraq then conducted a huge proxy war against Iran, where millions died. You know, I see him as personally responsible, at least in part, you know, for destabilizing the region. You know, and we're still experiencing those problems today as a result.
Charlie, thank you for that. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point. We're talking about George H.W. Bush and his foreign policy legacy. And something Charlie just said was how he believes that partly what Bush did played a role in destabilizing parts of the world. Of course, Bush was trying to keep them stabilized. You know, he talked about how we need kind of a slow, careful progression. And I'm wondering, Bruce, Jim, Corey, I'll let you decide who can answer this one. But, you know, some people would say that that caution was right for that time, for that era. Prudence is what was needed. The geopolitical situation was incredibly tense. The world was in dramatic transformation. You needed someone slow and steady and pragmatic. Do you believe that's true, and that perhaps we could argue that in different times you need someone more aggressive, less cautious?
Yeah, I would say foreign policy needs to be married to its time. And that the time that the elder President Bush was in office was a time where enormous advantages were accruing to the United States. And by being so prudential and so gentle in how he stabilized a changing order, he actually reduced the backlash against the United States and made sure that we didn't overcommit ourselves to outcomes that we weren't going to want to resource over the long haul, like overthrowing the president, the dictator in Iraq.
Jim, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think it's worth thinking about where the criticisms came from in the 1992 campaign regarding Bush's foreign policy. One was from Republican Pat Buchanan, who ran against him in the primaries, on the strategy of Come Home America and also America First and Second and Third. Arguing that Bush's internationalism was a problem. And I think you have panelists here today who would argue Bush's internationalism was a better approach. But there was also the Clinton criticism really coming, a criticism that came both from progressive Democrats and neoconservatives, which is Bush didn't care enough about human rights. And so you have the caller who pointed out the reaction to Tiananmen. Bush was accused of coddling the butchers of Beijing. There was a slowness and a real unwillingness to confront the situation in Yugoslavia. And even the slowness in recognizing that the Soviet Union was falling apart. Conservative columnist William Sapphire called Bush's speech in Ukraine in 1991 the Chicken Kiev speech.
Chicken
so
Kiev.
I think that's a sign that, you know, Bush had a certain internationalism, and it was about not overextending the United States, but that was costly in terms of U.S. support for issues related to human rights and support for democratic values.
And Bruce, could you close us out by talking a bit about what, I mean, he was only a one-term president. I mean, despite all the accolades we're hearing today, in the end, he couldn't win another term. And, you know, certainly that had in part to do with the economy doing very poorly. You know, Ross Perot got 19% of the vote that denied both Bush and Clinton the majority. Talk a bit about what eventually, despite the accomplishments we've discussed today, that wasn't enough to win him a second term.
Yeah, the irony, of course, was the end of the Cold War and the sense that we won and the other side lost led people think that foreign policy was no longer as important. And so in some respects, his great achievements, you know, contributed to less political potency for that issue, running against a governor of Arkansas and a businessman from Texas. A little bit ironic for him, the way that politics is kind of these pendulum swings. In fact, Winston Churchill wins World War II, and a year later, he's voted out of office. So, you know, the sense of the strengths, had he not won the Cold War, it had still been going on, maybe he would have won in 1992. And I think we've gotten a sense of what some of the weaknesses were of his foreign policy as well. You know, the Tiananmen Square, the over-tilting to Iraq, you know, because of the focus on Iran. But I think he, most of all, it's the way he conducted the policy, the dignity, the respect he had, and all of those things are really important in whoever is president, whatever party they are.
That's Bruce Gentleson. He's a professor at Duke University and author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. Also with us this hour has been Corey Shockey, Deputy Directory General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, and Jim Goldgeier, Visiting Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor at American University. Thanks to all three of you.
Good to be with
you. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Steph Kotsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Gretchen Voss, with help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.